threatens.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know,
catapult to propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
One of the fascinating things about the Bible is that while we don't understand the prophetic word of God clearly at this point, we will someday. And we know this is true because as we look backward in history, we can see how over and over again, things that were not clear have been fulfilled. And when we see them with 20/20 hindsight, we understand then how they were fulfilled perfectly and could only have been fulfilled in that way. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Our guest specializes his ministry really in looking at prophecy, looking at ancient texts, the teachings and writings of the early church fathers, pre-flood history, just fascinating periods of history, but looking at Bible prophecy especially, and he's in the middle of a series of DVD releases that give us a sense of the scope of prophecy from the time it was issued to the present day and then looking forward to Jesus' return. We welcome back to the program Dr. Ken Johnson. Ken, welcome back, and boy, I'm not quite sure where we're going to go today, but I know wherever we are led, it's going to be really interesting stuff. I saw you recently on Prophecy Watchers with our friend Gary Stearman, and talking about the basic outline of prophecy. Maybe let's start there, just to help us understand that there is a framework within which we are operating. And while we don't understand clearly what's coming our way, as we look back, we see over and over again how things have been fulfilled. When you look at, well, help us to get that sense, to understand what we're looking at here. What is it about prophecy or how it's been fulfilled that convinces you that Bible prophecy is absolutely sure and accurate and can be trusted?
Well, thanks for having me back on the program. Bible prophecy is amazing to study, and it's really important. And I think it's very easy to get lost in it, to get enraptured by it. We have a ton of different religions on the planet that all have some sort of a holy book that gives you an idea of how things started and how things end.
Right.
But none of them have prophecy in them detailing at a certain time a certain thing would happen. That's accurate. You know, none of them do, except, of course, for the Bible. And we have all the prophecies, and most people are aware of the prophecies up to the first coming of the Messiah and the baby born in Bethlehem and the star and things like that. But a lot of people are unaware that that stuff never stopped. I mean, the prophets may not continually be born, but the writings of the prophets, the information in them goes way beyond it. There's at least 20 prophecies about the church age in the first century, another 30 or so in the Middle Ages. There's been over 50 prophecies that Israel has fulfilled after its second return in the last 60 years. Isaiah chapter 11 even talks about the time when Israel returns for the second time, actually saying that. That has to be 1948 because there's only been two expulsions and two returns.
Right.
So, when you see these things happen in your lifetime, it's really amazing. And so no other Bible, no other holy book does that. So that tells us that the scriptures are something we need to take a very serious look at.
You talked a lot about the prophecies of Daniel in that discussion with Gary, and I found that to be really intriguing too. One of the things that, and I know Chuck Missler's talked about this, that convinces us that, convinced me that prophecy is worth taking seriously. It was understanding that Daniel nailed the arrival of the Messiah. And of course, as we're recording this in between Palm Sunday and Resurrection Sunday, Daniel nailed his arrival in Jerusalem to the year, but it was actually even more precise than that, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, most people are familiar with the Daniel chapter 9, the 70 weeks, and they usually focus on the tribulation period, the Antichrist and that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But the first part of that is that from the command, a certain command to rebuild Jerusalem, so many days forward, the Messiah will be cut off. And that happened to the day. It's one of those prophecies, just like when you go back in Exodus chapter 12 And it says that when Moses actually led the Exodus, it says that it fulfilled the prophecy God gave to Abraham to the day. Hmm. So it was exactly 430 years to the day. And a lot of prophecies are that way. We're told not to try to set the date for the rapture or the second coming. That's not the norm. That's the exception. Hmm. There are so many other prophecies where you're given dates throughout history. And so the death of the Messiah was supposed to come. And then there's this gap in which the Messiah dies, the temple's destroyed, Israel's dispersed, Israel comes back, Israel rebuilds the temple. And then you have this Antichrist guy in the last week. Mm-hmm. But Daniel also goes on and gives us the time of the second return of the nation of Israel. And that was fulfilled to the day. And the taking back of the Temple Mount at that point, which was fulfilled again to the day. And looking at those prophecies, there's no way you could accidentally wind up on that day.
No. There have been skeptics who said that Jesus of Nazareth was aware of the prophecies of Daniel and deliberately manipulated his own life in order to fulfill them, arriving in Jerusalem on the specific day to fulfill the prophecy. But he could not have fulfilled every other prophecy about him, the things from Isaiah 53, Psalm 22, things like that.
That's right. I mean, that's just looking at a few things that Jesus could or could not have done. When you look at not focusing on Jesus, but Daniel, for instance, Daniel prophesied and the other prophets prophesied all those things about Jesus.
Yes.
But then all of the other things, like the other 50 that I've seen in my lifetime, so there's no way they can be fake. A lot of people say that the book of Daniel is fake because in chapter 11, he's just way too accurate. Mm-hmm. There's no way it could have been written beforehand. So it had to have been a Jew writing about the time of the Maccabees. Except, of course, it goes past the Maccabee period into the Roman period, the destruction of the temple, all the way up to 1948 when they return. So again, even if it's a fake document, it's not a fake document. There's just no way around prophecy.
Exactly right. And just for people not familiar with Daniel chapter 11, that's the history of the Greek conquest, essentially, of the Holy Land under Antiochus IV, who was an archetype, if you will, of the Antichrist, set up the original abomination that causes desolation by, an altar to Zeus in the Holy of Holies and then sacrificed a pig?
I believe he did. Yeah. That was back about 165 BC.
Right. But Jesus also talked about that as a future event. So that will, something like that will happen again.
Right.
And as you point out, he also, we know that Daniel existed at the time that the Septuagint was translated, which is around 200 BC. So the stuff that came after that, the Roman conquest of the Greek world, for example, even if it wasn't actually Daniel the prophet who wrote the book of Daniel, whoever wrote it under the guidance of the Holy Spirit, still prophesied in advance all the way, as you say, to 1948. And the taking of the Temple Mount, explain that one. That was something I had not heard before. And that one is really intriguing.
Yeah, Daniel gives these timeline prophecies, and a lot of them are very, very cryptic. And they're supposed to be because you're not supposed to know about them till after the effect.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, when Jesus is born in Bethlehem and then disappears to Egypt, you don't want people going to Egypt, finding him and killing him. So it's some of those are cryptic. But if you take Daniel chapter 9, which is usually called the forbidden chapter as a proof text, so to speak, it says that from a certain event, so many days later, the Messiah is cut off. And so if you take and you just learn how to take their calendar, convert it to a number of days per year, just total up the days and then start with whenever the decree was, go forward that number of days, that's when the event should take place.
Mm-hmm.
And we find out that that was 32 AD. Well, there's other cryptic prophecies in there that talk about them returning under Cyrus. And from that event forward so many days, there would be another return. And that turned out to be 1948.
Hmm.
And then under Darius, they were supposed to take the Temple Mount, build the temple. They started, they were stopped. So they had control of the Temple Mount, but because of the people in the area causing problems, they couldn't actually build the temple, so they just had to wait on it. So exactly the same number of days, you know, as far as what's given in the cryptic prophecies in Daniel, comes out to be June 7th, 1967. And again, that's the date they take the Temple Mount. But for some reason, because of the people in the land and the area that don't like Jews, they can't actually build a temple. So it's amazing to see these things. And, you know, I guess you could manipulate a set of numbers. It'd be kind of hard. But to have three separate sets of numbers using the same type of calculations, it's impossible to fabricate.
Yeah. If you don't have that available right now, if you don't mind, send me the verses that refer to that, and I will include those in the show notes, because I'm sure that there are people who want to double check this for themselves, because it almost sounds too good to be true. There are those who are rightly critical of the geopolitical nation state of Israel. And or maybe go too far in the direction of making sure that we don't confuse God's chosen people with the political entity of Israel. And when I say you go too far, they go so far as to say that this current nation state of Israel can't be the fulfillment of the second arrival in the land because they are not a godly nation. So, you know, I disagree with that view, but I know that it is out there. And I think that there are those who miss the fact that in the case of, for example, Cyrus or even Nebuchadnezzar, where pagan kings were used to carry out the Lord's plans.
Mm-hmm.
So we may have a secular nation state in the form of the modern day state of Israel, but that does not mean that they aren't there at God's to fulfill God, the prophecies that God gave to Daniel and the other prophets thousands of years ago.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I think if you, for that particular concept, I think if you look at Ezekiel 37, the Valley of Dry Bones,
yeah,
it clearly talks about Israel coming back and then they come to life, but they don't have breath in them. You know, and so
right.
I think that's a very clear indication of the nation being restored, but they're not completely messianic, accepting Jesus as the Messiah.
Right.
So
right.
It was supposed to be like that for a while. And then eventually they get confused by the Antichrist. And then eventually they realize whom they've pierced.
Mm-hmm.
And the entire nation accepts the Messiah.
Oh.
So it happens in a sequence.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that's very true. I've been doing some reading lately for a project I'm working on and was surprised to find some I don't know if I want to call them Orthodox or ultra-Orthodox. Maybe I'll just say Zionist Jews, you know, very nationalistic, who will openly say that the reason they know Jesus of Nazareth wasn't the Messiah is because he wasn't anything like Simon Bar Kokhba. And, you know, very brief history lesson, Simon Bar Kokhba was a very dynamic leader in the early second century who led a revolt in Judea that threw off Roman rule for a short period of time, several years, had an independent Jewish state. They wiped out one and possibly two legions, which is astonishing for a people in a geographic area that small. I mean, that's something the Germanic tribes, you know, the Huns were never able to do that. You know, the Saxons and the Franks and, but the Jews wiped out the better part of two legions. Of course, the result was that Hadrian brought out the big guns and essentially depopulated Judea, sent the Jews off to slavery. The 600, you know, the ones that were left after about 600,000 got killed. But that is the kind of Messiah that many Jews who expect a Messiah are looking for. They want a geopolitical leader who's going to lead them to victory over their enemies. And that's why they say that's how we know it wasn't Jesus of Nazareth. Sadly, that guy looks a lot like the character described at the end of Daniel chapter 11.
Yeah, absolutely. That's how the Antichrist is going to appear to be the Messiah and go forward and fool them. And in a sense, they're kind of sort of right. Jesus did not come to rule and reign and set up a kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're looking for the time that he sets the kingdom up, it's not that he wasn't the Messiah. It wasn't that particular time or coming or advent of the Messiah.
Right, right.
So they're kind of sort of right. They're just looking at it wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the tragedy. But as you say, that verse about they will look on the one they've pierced, and that is, it just reminds me that that closing scene from in the movie Bridge Over the River Kwai, if you remember that movie, where Alec Guinness, who's the British colonel leading his captured soldiers to build a bridge for the Japanese, and it just as a matter of pride, they want to build the bridge and do it right and show the Japanese how, you know, British soldiers can keep their chins up even in the worst circumstances, and then realizes at the last moment, what have we done? We've just built this bridge so that Japanese supply trains can get across and fight the war more effectively. And at the last moment does the right thing. That's kind of the sense that I get from hearing those prophecies put side by side.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the early church fathers, you've done a lot of studying on the what do they call it? Patristics, the study of the early church fathers.
Yes.
Yeah. And we today have a number of different theories about, you know, who the Antichrist is, when the rapture is going to take place, whether Jesus comes back before or after the millennial reign, or whether the millennial reign is just a metaphor. What did the early church fathers, the one who were closest to the apostles, believe about the end times?
Yeah, I think that's one of the keys. We have to understand that the 66 books in our Bible are divinely inspired, 100% accurate. The things that we don't quite understand of it, we look at theologians that master Greek, Hebrew, Latin, studied it for all their life. But out of those, it would be better to talk to someone who could say, well, I wasn't sure, so I went and asked Peter and Paul and Mary and Barnabas and other guys that were there.
Yeah, I mean, we read in one of his letters, I think Galatians, where Paul writes that he spent 15 days with Peter and James, who was the half-brother of Jesus, in Jerusalem. After his Damascus experience, then wandering around Arabia for a few years, he went to Jerusalem, spent 15 days with the apostles there. And I suspect it was to find out from the guys who had actually walked side by side with Jesus, hey, this revelation I had, is this, you know, am I on the money here? What's, you know, guide me.
Yeah, definitely. Because the Lord's speaking to everybody, and there's nothing wrong with double checking to make sure that you understand it right.
Yeah, like the Bereans.
Well, the early church fathers, starting from the first century, most of them didn't talk about prophecy as a whole, but whenever a cult would come up and teach some wacky doctrine, they'd say, no, that's not correct because it's this. So you can go back in there through their sermons and pull out what they believed about a rapture and a second coming and basically everything. And that's what I've done over the years is try to do that. So Irenaeus, Justin Martyr, Barnabas, who wrote an epistle, most of those guys talk about the basic outline. They were all premillennial, so they believed in a literal future 1,000-year reign of Christ when he returns. He returns to destroy a man called the Antichrist, and that's during Daniel's last 70th week. So there's a period of 7 years right before the second coming. They're all attached, and all that is yet future. And most of the church fathers, what you'll learn about, is that most of them believed that we would have 6,000 years of human history and then a millennial reign. So most of them taught the second coming should be the year 6,000 AM on the Jewish calendar. But we all, of course, recognize the Jewish calendar is off. So if we knew the Jewish calendar was correct, I could pinpoint for you the exact date of the second coming and the rapture. So as far as what they taught and what they believed, mm-hmm. Of course, we can't because of the calendar dates, which actually is one of the prophecies out of the book of Enoch that the calendars would get messed up.
Mm.
But we can actually get a general idea of it. So basically from the church father's standpoint, they looked at the Messiah coming back somewhere in the neighborhood of the year 2000 or 2032 or something like that, somewhere okay. in that neighborhood, not necessarily imminent in their day.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting to see that. And you go through and you look at these things. I'm working on a book now. I should be able to have that along with at least two of these DVDs for the prophecy conference that's coming up in July in Colorado Springs. But in this, what I've done is I've went through and I've looked at specifically two guys, Hippolytus and Ephrem. And what's interesting about that is because they had problems in the Roman Catholic Church with some of the Roman Catholic popes in the third century. And Hippolytus was an antipope, meaning he was somebody that brought to the attention the corruption of the current popes, and to the point that he was almost elected as a replacement pope. So with that in mind, if you think about it, you have a guy that almost was a pope, so a great representative of Roman Catholicism. And then you have Ephrem, who was one of the top scholars, wrote probably hundreds of commentaries on scriptures, Dead Sea Scrolls, all sorts of stuff, top scholar on the Eastern Orthodox front. So you have a best representative of Roman Catholicism, Eastern Orthodoxy, both teaching what we would call Protestant theology. And so it's pretty amazing just to pull these together and say, well, that's kind of what I learned in seminary, you know, the basic order and this kind of stuff. But in pulling these together, they give a nice picture, but they also tell us things that they were told by the apostles. And some of it was new information to me. I would say one thing about Ephrem, because a lot of people that are non-pre-trib rapturous would say that that's called pseudo-Ephrem, you know, because it's a fake work. And that always is amazing to me because they don't really do their study on how it got its name that way. Nobody ever said anything about it not teaching proper doctrine. If it did, it would be considered a Gnostic work and be called heretical. And there's several church fathers that like it, that quote it, that say that it's legitimate. But there are two church fathers that quote it and say that it was written by Ephrem the Syrian.
Okay.
And there's one church father that quotes it and says that he thinks it was written by Isidore of Seville. Now, a lot of times we don't really care. Like, there is a debate on whether the Apostle Paul actually wrote Hebrews.
Right.
Or was it Barnabas or was it one of the others?
Apollos.
Again, we don't really care. It's inspired by the Word. The Holy Spirit put it in the canon. It's important for us to have. It's nice to know, but it's not super important who the two witnesses are of Revelation. It's what they teach. So in looking at this, it's pretty interesting that if there were two church fathers that said it was Isidore of Seville and one that said it was Ephrem, the title of the work would be called Pseudo-Isidore. You know, because we're not sure, but it's probably this guy. But it was two to one for Ephrem. So that's how it got its name. It's not that it was ever debated, because you could go back and look at Ephrem's other writings and see that in other places he taught basically the same thing. But it's nice because this is a work of his. It's 10 chapters called The End Times. You know, and Hippolytus wrote one on the Antichrist and another one on the Second Coming. So pulling all those together, I kind of make a nice chart of each one of those and show what they teach and in order things are supposed to happen. So it's pretty interesting. But throughout all the church fathers, one of the things that I always thought was interesting, they talk about how Daniel says that that Rome would end, and then out of what used to be part of the Roman Empire would pop these 10 nations at the end times. You know, and so we're all today in my time period, we're all looking for 10 nations anywhere. You know, I go to a Calvary chapel, and Pastor Chuck Smith, I remember many commentaries he did talking about Europe, you know, and the idea that the European common market was, or very well could be it. And good guess, because it started out with 10 nations. Now I think it's 23, you know, so it's went a little beyond that. And of course, some people say, well, yeah, but the original 10 are the only ones that get to vote on certain things. Well, it might be, because we're looking for something that's 10 nations out of what used to be the Roman Empire. And Europe counts, the Middle East counts, part of Africa counts, just anywhere that used to be part of the Roman Empire. But what's interesting about this is you look at some of the symbols in Daniel, and Daniel chapter 11 specifically, it starts off with Darius the Mede, and it shows the next three kings, and then the kingdom falls to the Greeks. The Greek kingdom breaks up into four parts, and the rest of the chapter is concerned with the king of the north and the king of the south fighting against Israel back and forth. And then it talks about Rome comes, Rome destroys the temple, the dispersion happens, and then the children of Israel come back, and then all of a sudden there's the king of the north again and attacking Egypt, you know, and these type of things. And so the church fathers basically all said that what that whole thing is showing us is that there's going to be this long gap toward the end of time when these 10 nations arise. They're going to be somewhere in the area of what used to be Rome. But the Antichrist, which is the 11th nation that pops up in the midst of the rest of them that takes them over, he is the king of the north. So he would be the king or president of Syria. And so I've always speculated Syria and or Iraq, probably not Lebanon because it's too small. And, you know, these days now we're talking about, well, what about ISIS? ISIS has popped up kind of in between those two, and there's the rebel forces, and
right.
You never know what's going to happen when this war is finally over, what kind of a government comes and this type of stuff. So it's an interesting thing that, again, all these nations are back in the limelight doing these things.
Yeah, and I think one of the points we need to make clear to listeners is that while we think of Rome as being Western Europe, Rome at its peak during the reign of, say, Augustus through about the time of Constantine had more or less control, not just of Western Europe as far as Britain, but also the Eastern Mediterranean. So Greece, what is now Turkey, the Levant, Syria, Lebanon, mm-hmm. what is now Israel, Jordan, down into Egypt. Egypt was the breadbasket of the empire there for a while. And that's where, yeah. You know, Mark Antony and Cleopatra tried to rebel, and that didn't work out so well for them. The dividing line between the Roman Empire and the Persian or Parthian empires was Mesopotamia, basically Iraq, and going up to the north, Armenia. Armenia was kind of a buffer state between Rome and Parthia or Persia during much of this history. So when you're talking about Rome, you know, and especially when you look back at the period of history in which these guys were writing, you know, what is Rome? Rome was everything from Britain to modern day Iraq and down into, you know, all of North Africa, including Egypt. So it's a much bigger area than we think. So the king of the north, I suppose you could speculate, could be as far as coming from Turkey.
Yeah, that's a possibility. Yeah, as far as just that prophecy, we've got that area up there. And then even you're talking about how extensive Rome was. We remember also, and I'd always thought of Rome as dividing and then falling apart in 476, but that's Western Rome.
Right, the Eastern Empire.
I tend to forget that the, you know, Eastern Rome became the Byzantine Empire.
Right.
They switched from Latin to Greek. That's where the Greek Orthodox Church got its strength.
Yes.
And it continued to exist until the Muslims took Byzantium, or Istanbul, as it's called today. I think that was like 1453.
I think that's the number that comes to my mind, too. So it was almost 1,000 years before the Eastern Empire, Byzantium, fell.
Yeah, so that's something to think of, too. They didn't have a whole lot of Europe at the time, but they had a lot more of that other area. So, you know, how much... I mean, definitely something like South Africa is not one of the 10 nations because it was never in any Roman Empire,
right.
You know. So it's those things are given to us for clues, and we need to keep looking at them really close and looking at other things.
And the north was always in Israelite history, the direction from which invaders came, because you couldn't really make it across the desert back in the day on camelback, mm-hmm. Of course, the foot soldiers who didn't have a ride. Had to follow the rivers, basically, for the water supply into what is now northern Syria and then drop down from the north. Mm-hmm. So whenever Babylon or Assyria or the Persians came into attack, the Akkadians or whoever wanted to raid into Canaan or later Israel, they always came from that direction. The Hittite Empire, the Arameans, you know, they were always coming from the north. And I don't think it's a coincidence that... there's a mountain on the Syrian coast. It's near it's not Antioch today. It's the name is similar, but it's anyway, Antioch, Mount Acra, which back in the day was called Mount Zaphon, which is the Hebrew word for north. And that was considered to be the holy mountain of Baal. That's where Baal's palace was located.
Mm-hmm.
So, north had a negative connotation all throughout Israelite history. And, that clearly would have been known to the scholars like Daniel.
So, yeah, definitely. It's amazing how all that stuff comes together. I think that's one thing that we miss. A lot of times people will try to learn Greek and Hebrew, and that will help a little bit. But there's a lot of the history that you just don't know unless you were there or unless you've read and studied those documents over a period of thousands of years to get a good sense of the history.
Well, one of the things that really blew my mind is when Sharon and I, during our weekly Bible studies, we were at the section of Exodus where they were getting ready to cross the Red Sea, and found that God told Moses to tell the Israelites to turn around, and they were going to cross at a place called Pi Hahiroth, which was opposite Baal Zephon, Baal of the North, Mount Zephon, where Baal's palace was, even down into Egypt, in, you know, by the Red Sea. Baal of the North was venerated there. It was almost like God told them to turn around so they could do it right there. So they, it's like a called shot. Next one's going out of the park. Baal, we're coming for you. Mm-hmm. So that's a theme that is woven through all of Scripture. And getting back to the early church fathers, one of the things I learned about Hippolytus, and you know, I've basically got a Wikipedia level understanding of these guys, so I'm not comparing, you know, calling myself a scholar by any stretch, but finding that Hippolytus was a student of Irenaeus, and Irenaeus was a student under Polycarp. Mm-hmm. And Polycarp was a disciple of John, who wrote the book of Revelation.
Right.
So is it conceivable that Hippolytus and his interpretations, and we'll get back to more of what he actually believed here in a moment, but is it possible that he actually got it transmitted from John, his understanding of the Antichrist?
I believe so. I mean, it's always possible, even if he was 100% accurate, it's possible in the last 2,000 years his text could have got garbled.
Sure.
Because again, it's not protected like our Bible is. But at the same time, it's an interesting story because you've got John goes to the island of Patmos, writes the book of Revelation, gets released, goes back. His headquarters is in Ephesus, and he continues to plant churches. Well, Polycarp not only is his student, but works with him for over 20 years in ministry, planting churches. John dies and is buried in Ephesus, and then we learn from Irenaeus that Irenaeus said that he studied under Polycarp directly when he was young. He makes a comment. He's talking with Pope Victor, and I forget what it was, but the Pope of Rome did something really stupid. And so he writes the Pope and he says, look, I'm an old man. I don't remember. I can't even remember really what I ate for breakfast this morning. It just doesn't work anymore. He actually says this in his text. And he says, but when I was a kid, I remember everything back then crystal clear. Hmm. I can tell you of the times when we used to go out and sit under the trees and study under Polycarp. And occasionally the Apostle John would come, and I would get to talk with him and verify teachings, and I got to know them both very well. You just have to be very, you know, respectful and careful with the old guy. And then he says, but I can tell you, if you would have said something like you just decreed in their presence, they'd stand up, clap their hands together, and say, oh God, why did you let me live long enough to see such rank heresy in the church?
Wow.
Turn around, and they would walk out of here, and they would never speak to you again.
Wow.
I'm telling you this. I know. I was there. So I recommend that you fix this problem.
Hmm.
And so it's interesting to see, you know, things like that in the church, but you have that as a testimony of Irenaeus, and then Hippolytus studied under him for years.
Mm-hmm.
So Hippolytus, I'm sure, didn't directly meet John. He may have met Polycarp, but you're talking about third-hand information, you know, at best, but that's pretty decent. I'm sure there were a lot of other people, not just Irenaeus, but other people that would have been elderly that could have said, oh, yeah, I remember too, or my dad used to work with him, and mm-hmm. he told me stories. So it's in that same area where you get all this stuff. And these guys, when any time somebody would come up and say something wrong, they're immediately attacked as a heretic.
Mm-hmm.
And so you stand up and say, well, I think it's this way, and I think the millennium, and I think the second coming, and I think this. If you're not immediately attacked, you must be doing pretty good.
Mm.
And so everybody tends to say, yeah, these guys were taught like us, and this is the gospel we've been handed down. So it's a pretty straightforward shot.
Hmm.
And I think it's, again, we don't want to take everything they say as gospel,
right.
But I think we need to pay more attention to them than people in our time that are speculating.
Well, and if for no other reason than, you know, now Hippolytus, who lived in the late second, early third century, so about 170 to about 235 AD, probably had a better understanding of life and the worldview of the the world of the apostles, the worldview of the apostles as well, being only maybe 125 years removed, probably had a closer understanding of it because things hadn't changed quite as much in that day and age than, say, between us and the age of my, our great grandfathers in the late 1800s, 1880, 1890. Mm-hmm. And yet we could probably relate to somebody from 1890 America a lot more easily than we could somebody from, say, the Middle East in the first century. Just a completely different way of life, completely different worldview, completely different attitudes about things. And again, Hippolytus, just a couple generations removed from the apostles, as you say, not that we should take his words as gospel, but at least give his interpretation of what he received from the apostles as perhaps a little better informed than our own.
Right.
So what was it? Now, you mentioned that he identifies the 10 nations and specifies Egypt, Libya, and Sudan. Now, is that based on the text of Daniel 11?
I believe so. Sometimes you wonder where they get their stuff, but talking about that, he actually mentions several really interesting things. The second half of Daniel 11, we tend to skim over, but there's several things there that are really interesting. He says that the Antichrist, of course, is the king of the north. That would make him the king of Syria. Mm-hmm. And he goes to war specifically with Egypt. And of course, Isaiah and other places talk about him destroying Egypt to the point that the Nile River ceases to exist. I mean, it's completely devastated. That could be done very easily with a small tactical nuke up in the mountains to just change the water flow.
Yeah.
You know, but anyway, it talks about that, and it talks about the other three with him. And the verse that I always speculated and wondered about it, because it said Libya and Ethiopia would be at his steps.
Right, right.
And I don't really know what that means. Yeah, does that mean coming behind you to clean up? Is it your friend or is it attacking you?
Yeah,
but it's Daniel, got something to do with it.
Yeah, Daniel 11:43, all the precious things of Egypt and the Libyans and the Cushites or the Ethiopians or Sudan shall follow in his train. Mm-hmm. So it sounds almost like they've gone down there, raided and taken plunder.
Yeah. But it was Irenaeus and Ephraim's concept that means that they would be the first. So it's almost sounding like it's an African bloc, an African Muslim bloc, mm-hmm. that doesn't like the fact that he's saying to the Jews, I am Messiah, I am going to rebuild the temple, we're going to have a peace plan now, you know, land for peace type deal, but I'm going to enforce it. And it's almost like Egypt and Libya, and it says Ethiopia, but Ethiopia used to be Ethiopia and Sudan.
Right.
You know, that's one of the riddles, like in Isaiah 18, it talks about the land of Ethiopia beyond the waters of Ethiopia. So even back in Isaiah's day when it was one. He saw in the future they would be split in two.
Right.
So we're probably talking about Sudan. And so because those all used to be in the Roman Empire, or a part of them used to be in the Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. And so it looks like if Hippolytus is right, you have those three that are attacking. So those three are in some sort of a league of 10 nations. Syria, if it's Syria we're talking about, is not. It's the 11th that came up. But it's putting it all in the area there of the Middle East, which I think is interesting. However, one thing that no one has said, the church fathers, but I've often thought about too, is that in Nebuchadnezzar's image, you've got the chest and arms of silver, mm-hmm. meaning the Medo-Persian Empire, two people. The two legs of Rome, obviously, are East and Western Rome. And unless the image is weird, it's got five toes on each foot.
Yeah.
So that always made me wonder if it's not five European nations and five Middle Eastern nations.
That's an interesting thought. I had never considered that.
Yeah. I always wondered that, and I thought, yeah, but there's no – Muslims don't really work too well together, let alone with non-Muslims.
Oh, that's a fact.
So I don't know how that would work, except we have a lot of Muslims now coming into Europe, and if that's not checked, it could very easily become Muslim.
Yeah.
We remember before World War I, Greece was part of the Ottoman Empire for a while.
Yep.
So they had expanded that far. So it's hard to tell, but it's just things to think about. But Hippolytus also mentioned a few other things that I thought was interesting. I had looked at the Hebrew of the text when it says that he will plant the tabernacles of his pavilion. I'm quoting King James, but mm-hmm. it says that between the seas and the holy mountain.
Right.
So I'm looking at that thinking, okay, if we're talking about Dead Sea, holy mountain be Jerusalem, and the Sea of Galilee, that's a good portion of the West Bank. So maybe the West Bank will end up becoming an independent state.
Hmm.
So I'm looking at that, and I'm thinking, like, I wonder if one of these words can be translated, because it's kind of odd to say the tents of his pavilion, mm-hmm. or the tent of his tents. It's kind of odd if one of them could be a proper name of a city. So I'm looking around for this, trying to figure it out, and I actually looked up the commentary for that verse in by Gill, mm-hmm. Who's a 16th century Bible commentator. And he's making a comment about it, and he says, he goes back to Theodoret, who's one of the church history guys. The father of church history, of course, is Eusebius. Does an excellent work from Christ's time up to 325. Then you've got Theodoret, Sozomen, and Socrates that pick up where he left off and go forward. But Theodoret made mention of the area that we call Emmaus. Remember when Jesus appeared to the two disciples that were
on
the road to Emmaus? That Emmaus would be the place where he would put his tents. That's what that place was called. And it's a kind of a plateau. If you're going to bring in an invading army, you're going to put it right there. Well, I went and looked it up, and it's right at the border, but it's actually in the Western Bank.
Mm-hmm.
At the moment. So it's kind of interesting to say that the Antichrist would bring his people there. It's right in between Israel and the mountains and the sea. It'd be a good place to control things. And then I noticed that if you go back and you look up, because Antiochus Epiphanes is supposed to be a type of the Antichrist. So if you go back to 1 Maccabees mm-hmm. and you read the story of when Antiochus Epiphanes came in, when he was really ticked off and he came in to totally control and destroy, He comes in with his troops, and he parks his troops in Emmaus mm-hmm. in the exact same spot that Daniel prophesied that this would happen. I thought that was pretty interesting. And I went and looked it up, and in the earlier part of our century, some Arabs had started a community, and it grew into a fairly nice-sized city, which would kind of mess up the prophecy. You can't have people coming into a plateau if there's already a city there. But then I realized that, according to the history, in 1967, during the war where Israel took back the Temple Mount, in the midst of that war, that whole city was destroyed. And so now it's just a plain again.
Ah, okay.
So it's really interesting how all those things kind of fit together.
Hmm. Now, I had assumed that that was going to be the sea referred to the Mediterranean. So I was looking to the west of Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a possibility. It says the seas and the holy mountains. So Mediterranean, Galilee, and Jerusalem, or Galilee, Dead Sea, Jerusalem, or Jerusalem, Mediterranean, and Dead Sea. So breaking it up somewhere like that.
Yeah,
and that's the thing with all these. It's a riddle, and it's fairly easy to understand. But then there's like three choices instead of one.
Right. Right.
So,
and I think that as we're looking at this, we need to look back. This is a point Mike Heiser makes in his book, The Unseen Realm, that the prophecies of the Messiah's first coming were not understood even by the apostles after his resurrection. I mean, 40 days with him after the resurrection, and they were still asking him just before he was taken up into heaven at the Mount of Olives, are you going to restore the kingship to Israel now? They didn't get it. Until it was in hindsight, and that was the point I made at the beginning of the program. I don't think we should expect the prophecies of his second coming to be any more clear. And Paul alludes to this in 1 Corinthians 2, verse 8, where he says, none of the rulers of this age, and he's referring to principalities and powers here, not political figures, none of the rulers of this age understood this, for if they had, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. They thought they were destroying Jesus by taking him to the cross because they didn't understand the prophecies, because God in his wisdom left it just opaque enough that they didn't get it. They knew who Jesus was, obviously. We see that in all of the confrontations with the demons that he casts out, that they know who he is, but they just don't know why he's there. Because if they had, they would have done everything in their power to prevent the crucifixion. Probably same thing holding true for the prophecies of Jesus' return. We're getting a picture that will be clear in retrospect, but in advance, maybe we need to just be a little more gracious to people who disagree with our point of view, because they might be right.
Oh, definitely.
And it's by design, because God doesn't want the enemy to fake us out with a really, really convincing deception, which sadly, I think a lot of people are going to be fooled anyway. But Hippolytus, I've seen his name used by those who support the idea of a Middle Eastern Antichrist, as opposed to a Roman Antichrist. I know it was popular during the time of the Reformation, I guess, was the idea arose that the Pope would be the Antichrist or the false prophet or some such thing. Hippolytus and Irenaeus were used to support the idea of a Middle Eastern Antichrist. What does Hippolytus tell us about who he thinks the Antichrist will be?
Well, I think that's pretty much, this is before 600, so it's before Islam.
Yes.
However, there are prophecies in the scriptures, like in Isaiah, that talk about when Israel does come back the second time, there will be nations that surround her that have a particular religion. Of course, that's Islam.
Right.
Then it begins to tell you what God thinks of it, and we see enemy forces, like one particular enemy that's out for blood for Israel is going to be called Hamas. You know, we see that in Bible prophecy. But Irenaeus and Hippolytus and Ephraim didn't say so much about the Arab peoples, as I think the main point is when they said that the Antichrist would be the king of the north, just like in the old times, the Syrian Babylonian block there somewhere. Mm-hmm. And I think that primarily is it, because if you're thinking that the Antichrist is in the middle of 10 nations, and these 10 nations are over around Britain or Europe, then it's Belgium or it's Spain or something like that. If the Antichrist is coming from Syria, then you kind of expect the 10 nations, if they're all in one spot, to be Middle Eastern. Like I say, it could be, you know, part of one and part of the other. But I think that immediately comes to mind, because we've had Islam came up in the 600s, so it's been around about 1,400 years. Mm-hmm. Not much has changed. And so Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Persia, and they tend to battle each other because they're different factions of Islam, but they're all Islamic and been Islamic for well over 1,000 years. Mm-hmm. So if the rapture is going to happen in the next even 10, 20 years, it's unlikely that all of those are going to be something other than Islam in the next 10 years. Mm. So we're kind of talking about some sort of an Islamic concept. But remember, the Antichrist pulls together everybody. So the great deception is, if you're a Muslim, he is the Mahdi. Mm-hmm. If you're an apostate Christian, you're going to think he is the second coming or the reincarnation or whatever of Jesus Christ.
Right.
You know, the Buddhists will think he's another manifestation of Buddha, and the Hindus, Krishna, and this type of stuff. So, and one of the things I thought was interesting is you've got lots of different kinds of Muslims. Sunni and Shia are the top ones. But the rulership in Syria has been one of the few places where you've got Alawite Muslims. And the Alawites are very open to the concept that Allah could theoretically incarnate in human form.
Oh, really?
Normally, that's heresy for all the other Muslims.
Right.
And I thought it's interesting, if the Antichrist does arise out of Syria, then and say that I am God incarnate, that wouldn't be a problem for Alawite Muslims, and they're already in power. So
yeah, they basically had to do that as a matter of self-preservation when the French ruled that area, Lebanon, Syria, back in the day. The Alawites were allowed to enter the military, and that's how Bashar Assad's father, Hafez Assad, managed to get himself into a position where he could then mount the coup and take over the country, because the Alawites as a minority have been persecuted by Sunnis and Shias both, who both consider the Alawites to be heretics. Mm-hmm. And because the Alawites needed to draw on the support of other persecuted groups like the Druze, which is another sect of Islam that's considered heretical by all the other Muslims, and the Christians who still remained in Syria, that the Druze and the Christians had a better deal going by allying themselves with the Alawites than trying to get along with a majority, a leader from the majority Sunni sects in Syria. That's a real mess there. Now, as I understood the teachings of Hippolytus, though, I think he was a little more specific in identifying the Antichrist. He was a proponent of the theory that the Antichrist would come from the tribe of Dan.
Yes, actually. And that's always been confusing to me until, like I say, I've recently taken his two main books and studied them really. It's amazing because when you say the Antichrist is from the tribe of Dan, the first thing that I think of is that his father and his father before him are Danite Jews, wherever they may be on the planet, I don't know, but a direct descendant like that.
Yeah.
And what Hippolytus pointed out, I thought was something fascinating. They all say this, Irenaeus, Hippolytus, Ephraim, and several of the other guys say, yeah, the Antichrist comes from the tribe of Dan. And so you think, well, he's got to be Jewish, and first we need to find out where the Danites are, because anybody could say they're Danite.
Sure.
So how do we figure this out? Because I don't know if they even, you know, are identified. Like the Manasseh have been found up in India somewhere, Bangladesh, but I don't know if anybody's ever found any Danites yet. But one of the
there are theories that, you know, the Irish, the Celts believe that they're descendants of the Tuatha De Danann, and you know, there are theories out there, but you can't prove any of them, and there's no DNA evidence that suggests that theory is correct. I know that there's been a recent move to unite Gentiles, frankly, under a group calling itself the B'nai Yosef or B'nai Ephraim, you know, and say that we're the spiritual descendants of the 10 northern tribes, that we want to reunite with the tribe of Judah. It's really a Hebrew roots type thing. But again, that's not really it. I mean, because again, but I can understand why Dan would be one of the, as Hippolytus puts it, because the prophecy that Jacob spoke over Dan on his deathbed, called Dan a Lion's Club, and he shall leap from Bashan.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Jesus was the Lion of Judah, the Antichrist being a false Christ or a poor copy will also be a lion. That makes sense. Bashan, also known as the gates to the underworld, the cities of Ashtaroth and Edrei in the old kingdom of Og of Bashan were known as the entrances to the underworld. So it was known as the place of the Nakash, an evil place. And that was part of Dan's territory after they couldn't secure their original homeland on the coast. They went up north and at the foot of Mount Hermon, in fact, and took that territory there. So there's a lot of that there. But then, 2,000 years down the road, how do we know who is or is not a Danite?
Yeah. Well, that's the key to the whole thing. We're looking at the prophecy backwards.
Oh.
And let me explain it to you. This is really cool. I finally figured this out because of the way Hippolytus said it. Everybody else says the same thing. The Antichrist is of the tribe of Dan. They're absolutely correct, but it doesn't mean what you think it means. And to help understand this, for instance, we are told that Jesus the Messiah is a direct descendant of Judah.
Yes.
Okay, so if you go to his father, somewhere further back, you get back to King David. So he is a direct lineage of King David. He's supposed to rule. Okay, that's one prophecy. Now set that aside. Another prophecy is that he is from the tribe of Judah.
Mm-hmm.
Now think about this for a minute. Jerusalem is in the area of the old tribe of Benjamin.
Right, right.
So if you go 6 miles towards the south, you run into the itty-bitty town of Bethlehem.
Mm-hmm.
Bethlehem is just across the border. It's in the area of the tribe of Judah. So Jesus, according to Micah, was supposed to be born in Bethlehem.
Mm-hmm.
The other prophecy said Jesus is born of the tribe of Judah. He was. He was down in Bethlehem. He wasn't born in Jerusalem. Okay?
Right.
So add to that the fact that another prophecy says in the area of Zebulun and Naphtali, light will spring up. And he will be a light unto the Gentiles.
Hmm.
So we go look at the area of Zebulun and Naphtali, and it's the western side of the Sea of Galilee,
right,
which is exactly where Jesus started his ministry
and
was a light unto the Gentiles.
Right. Capernaum was, located there. And yeah, okay. Yeah. A lot of his miracles took place there. Bethsaida, the feeding of the 5,000 men.
Yeah, Peter's home was there. Yeah.
Right, right, right. Okay.
So if you look at that way, then forgetting about the lineage part, Jesus was born in Bethlehem, which is in Judah. His ministry started in Zebulun and Naphtali. So looking at it like that, if you're going to say the Antichrist is born of the tribe of Dan, and we're not talking about lineage, where is Dan? Dan of Bashan, actually, is what it said.
Yes.
So the Antichrist will be born in the area of the Syrian Golan Heights.
Right.
We're talking about where he's born, not necessarily who he's descended from.
Right, right. And I think we need to be clear, and I have not read enough of Hippolytus or Irenaeus to know what their specifics were on this point. Again, I've just got a wiki level of knowledge here, but the Antichrist will present himself perhaps as a Jew, but will certainly not be a Jew, not in the sense of being observant and truly seeking the face of Yahweh to, you know, be faithful to him.
Right.
But
that also is in chapter 11 of Daniel. It describes the weird religious system that he concocts about us being godlike and him being God incarnate, and he worships a god of fortresses or forces.
Yes, with the help of a foreign god.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And of course, the Golan Heights was Syrian territory, now held by Israel, but also home to a number of Druze enclaves.
Mm-hmm.
That was, in fact, some of the, if I'm not mistaken, there was a recent leader of Hezbollah who was killed, and it was believed that Hezbollah leadership did it because they weren't too sure of his loyalties, if he was going to be more loyal to the Druze, and they're worried about the Druze siding with the Israelis, than he was to Hezbollah. So that's, okay.
Well, it's really interesting. Hippolytus could be wrong on that point, but it is interesting how he brings it out. He talks about another prophecy, I think in Jeremiah, that talks about Dan coming and ruling over Israel with a fleet of ships and large amount of horses, and he's got an ironclad rule. And he makes the comment that the only ruler we've ever had from the tribe of Dan was Samson.
That's
right. And he didn't do that. And so it's got to be a yet future person of the tribe of Dan that has this kind of an army behind him. So he uses that and speculates that we're talking about the Antichrist being born in that area. Mm-hmm. I don't know anything that gives us a specific city.
No.
But he describes a lot of other things like that. It's just fascinating to see it through their eyes. And, if they're right, we definitely need to be looking in the right area.
Yeah, need to kind of rethink some of our assumptions. There's a real temptation on the part of us to live in the age in which we're living, which I guess, boy, that was a dumb way to put it. But to look at the enemy du jour, the bad guy of the day, and pick them as the likely place for the Antichrist, and we see that even happening today, even though we're some years past the traditional Cold War period. We still can look at Russia and say, okay, Vladimir Putin, he must be Gog of Magog because we just, he's shifty, we can't trust him. And during the Reformation, as I said, the Pope, he must be the Antichrist. But now with the rise of radical Islam, especially the last 2 years with the rise of the Islamic State, the Antichrist must be a Muslim. Yeah, but he sets up his palatial tents or the tabernacles of his tents somewhere near the holy mountain, which has got to be Zion. Mm-hmm. He reinstitutes the sacrifice, which means a third temple gets built. Mm-hmm. And do we really think that a Gentile or a Muslim is going to accomplish that? I mean, you think the Jews 2,000 years ago rose up against the most powerful empire in the world because the Emperor Hadrian wanted to set up a temple to Jupiter on the site of the temple, which had been destroyed 60 years earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was a suicide mission, but they did it anyway, because that's how passionately and nationalistic they were. You think somebody's going to come in, an outsider, and say, okay, yeah, I'm going to build a new temple here? I don't think so. It's going to be somebody that can convince a majority of the Israelis that he is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense to me anyway. I don't think it's going to be a real popular theory with most evangelical Christians. But, you know.
Well, again, I think we have to understand, Paul said that if the deception is so brilliant, so to speak, that if it were possible, even the elect would be deceived.
Yeah.
And so he is going to say, I am some sort of a representative of Jesus Christ. I'm filled with the Holy Spirit. Mm-hmm. I am the Mahdi. I am the Messiah. I am the Krishna. I am the Buddha. Y'all guys need to rally around me and I'll fix things. And he'll do all sorts of miracles to prove that he is supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's especially the miracle part, doing those, I think a lot of people will fall for it.
Yeah, yeah. And what's really intriguing is that we're at an age in history now where technology really is almost indistinguishable from magic. That's, of course, paraphrasing a famous quote attributed to Arthur C. Clarke. But in fact, I was just looking at some video today that was sent to me by listeners of a new video tool that will allow somebody with a video cam and a video of some other face, and it will basically superimpose facial expressions onto the face. You could basically take a video of, say, Donald Trump sitting there and then superimpose how I'm moving my eyebrows and my mouth, you know, to make it look like he's saying and doing things that he's not really doing.
Right.
Now, consider 100 years ago, the famous Bible scholar E.W. Bullinger, who is credited with coming up with the Gospel and the Stars,
mm-hmm.
in his commentary on the Book of Revelation, after hearing that Nikola Tesla was working on an artificial brain, speculated that the image of the beast that is given life could be a mechanical simulacrum of a human being, an artificial brain. And here we are in this 21st century era when robots are almost lifelike,
mm-hmm.
and they're almost autonomous in their artificial intelligence. So anyway, it just don't know if technology is going to play a role in that particular deception, but we're almost to the point where that is technologically possible.
Yeah, I've often wondered, you know, how they, I think everybody agrees on this, when the Antichrist does come into power, he has hordes of demons that are working with him. And of course, demons at this point are disembodied spirits. I wonder how easy it would be to create some sort of a robot type creature that a disembodied spirit could possess.
Well, Sharon and I have talked about that before. If you, considering that the human brain is essentially an electromechanical device, you know, our thoughts are formed and communicated and transmitted to the muscles of, you know, my speaking apparatus through a series of electrical signals. And scientists have no clue as to how those are created or sent. And they're spending hundreds of millions of dollars, literally, billions to try to replicate it, but they have no clue as to how it works. And we know that the human brain can be overwhelmed by an external non-corporeal force, like a demon.
Mm-hmm.
Why couldn't an electronic thinking machine, like an artificial intelligence, a supercomputer, similarly be possessed?
Right.
It's worth speculating. I don't know the answer to that question, but I think it's possible.
Yeah, there's lots of theories on that and about the beast that the Antichrist creates and the abomination in the temple. But then you think about maybe hundreds or thousands of those things.
Yeah, yeah. It is, well, gosh, an hour has flown by as I kind of expected it would. But if you're listening to this program, this is the kind of discussion that you will hear at the Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference. Ken Johnson is one of the featured speakers at the conference. So just imagine getting an opportunity to hear the presentations and then ask questions afterward. If you're going, we look forward to seeing you there. And it is sold out now, by the way. So if you have not yet registered, your next best option is to sign up for the live video stream. And I'll post a link on how to do that in the show notes at vftb.net. But yeah, Ken, we'll have to sit down at the conference and over dinner or coffee or something and just sit and talk and see who else we can rope into the conversation, because this is the kind of thing that can keep me engaged and interested all night.
Yeah, it will be. It'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah. Ken, where do people go to follow your work and your video teaching series?
You can go to BibleFacts.org, and I've tried to make it, I'm in the process of making a website mainly just videos. So there's a lot of free videos teaching things and some PDF handouts prophecy charts, things like that. There's direct links from there to Amazon where you can buy any of the books or DVDs. Right now I have, I believe, 24 books and 2 DVDs out.
Fantastic. BibleFacts.org, and there will be a link to that in the show notes as well. Ken Johnson, we look forward to seeing you in July. If we don't, if we don't see you sooner, I know we're going to be up in your neck of the woods for a family wedding in May, but I suspect we're going to be a little busy that weekend. So
that sounds like you'd be busy.
Yeah, but we will definitely see you in July at in Colorado Springs.
All right. Well, sounds good.
The show notes, as always, are posted at vftb.net. That's vftb.net. And there will be a link there to Ken's website, BibleFacts.org. This was delayed a week for a couple of reasons. First of all, I had forgotten when I originally scheduled Ken to be on the program that the Sunday I was going to post the program was Resurrection Sunday, or Easter if you prefer. But on top of that, as you can tell, my voice still is in recovery mode from the virus that went around the offices at Skywatch TV a couple of weeks ago. I feel better than I sound. It's just that whatever had attacked the respiratory system, my sinuses and so forth, has settled in my bronchial passages, and I'm still coughing it out. So even if I had wanted to put up a program last week, trust me, there was no voice coming out. It would have been painful to listen to, even worse than this. So anyway, appreciate your patience in putting up with the two-week delay. A couple of items in the news that I found interesting over the last couple of weeks, and of course, there's a lot out there. And if you really, if you want a daily update on what's going on, there are a couple of ways to do this, because 4 days a week, Monday through Thursday, we're posting daily news and analysis at Skywatch TV. And you can get that on Roku or on the Skywatch TV YouTube channel. But there's also a Skywatch TV podcast. So if you just want an audio version, you can subscribe to the Skywatch TV podcast. It's at skywatchtv.com. And then in the top menu bar, you'll see a link to the podcast. Or if you subscribe through iTunes, you'll find the Skywatch TV podcast in the iTunes store. And not just the daily updates, plus the program that Sharon and I have been producing now for, 6 months, the Sci Friday podcast will also be part of that. And then the audio versions of the weekly programs. So you've got basically everything that Skywatch TV putting out there at the Skywatch TV podcast. That also includes the excellent new program by Josh Peck and his wife, Christina, called Into the Multiverse. So lots of interesting stuff. And very soon, Chris Putnam will be joining the team. Chris and Shelley will be out here before long. I know they were hoping to be out here. In fact, even as I record this, but that is in the works. They'll be out here very soon. And then Chris will be taking on responsibility for a new program, I think tentatively titled The Supernatural Worldview, which is the title of his book. And that ought to be fascinating as well. He will be here in the Ozarks tomorrow. In fact, later today, as I record this on Monday, April 4th. And hopefully I can get him for a Skywatch, or rather for a View from the Bunker interview while he's here. Assuming I can, you know, talk. I don't know. Sharon kind of likes this Lance Henriksen sound. So maybe I'll just try to work on keeping this if I can. Anyway, last week, Monday, the Temple Institute in Jerusalem announced that they are looking for the Kohanim, the Kohen line. These are men who are eligible to prepare the red, would be eligible to prepare the red heifer, according to Numbers chapter 19. The first part of Numbers chapter 19 describes a rather mysterious ritual, which is finding a perfect, unblemished red heifer that's never worn the yoke. And a special way that it needs to be prepared in the ashes mixed with water. And then those used to purify the priests for temple service and also the ground, according to Jewish belief. This would need to be done in advance of building the third temple in order to purify the earth, essentially, to be worthy of the third temple. Now, the Temple Institute has been in existence for some years now, and they are working on assembling the utensils needed for temple service and in training priests for temple service. They've got all of the utensils that they need now. Obviously, they don't have the Ark of the Covenant, the Ark of the Testimony, but they think they know where it is. I know that there are archaeologists and, some trained, some amateur like, you know, the late Ron Wyatt, who think that they pinpointed the location of the ark, but the Jewish rabbis say, no, they don't know what they're talking about. We know where it is. Unfortunately for them, it's under the Temple Mount, and the Waqf, which is the Islamic authority that controls access to the Temple Mount, won't let them dig there. But I suspect if and when the time comes, they'll just go ahead and do it, and we'll find out if they're right. Now, there are some who believe that Jeremiah snuck it out and hid it in a cave on Mount Nebo, which is in Jordan. That's on the east side of the Jordan River. It's the site from which Moses saw the Holy Land before he died. There's a belief that Jeremiah, before the Babylonians under Nebuchadnezzar, came and broke down the walls and looted the temple, took the ark, and hid it on Mount Nebo. We may never know. But whether they find it or not, it really isn't going to be necessary for the third temple. Jesus called Herod's temple my father's house, and it didn't have the ark in it. The ark basically disappears from history after the time of King Joash, I believe. I think the last mention is in 2 Chronicles. I don't have that in front of me. But anyway, it kind of disappears from history after that point. And there was some speculation that it was taken by the son of the Queen of Sheba, and it's on Elephant Island, Elephantine Island in Ethiopia. Again, others who believe that it's under the Temple Mount, including the Jewish rabbis, others who believe it's out in the Judean desert. So, who knows? But the call is out for eligible Kohanim. These are men who could trace their ancestry all the way back to Aaron and would be eligible there to prepare the red heifer, which is a prerequisite under Jewish law for the construction of the third temple, which we know is going to happen someday because prophecy tells us that the Antichrist will reestablish the daily sacrifice, and there's got to be a temple if there's going to be a sacrifice. So there's that. It is unfortunate that, as I've done a little reading on Jewish eschatology recently for a project I'm working on, hopefully that I will bring this to fruition by this summer, that they're looking for the wrong man. There's no other way to put it. You know, we love our Jewish brothers and sisters, but when you begin to read what the rabbis are looking for, the characteristics of the Messiah that they're looking for, there's no other way to put it. From a Christian perspective, they're looking for the wrong man. Some go so far as to say they know that Jesus of Nazareth wasn't the Messiah because he was nothing like Simon Bar Kokhba. And if you know your history, Simon Bar Kokhba was the leader of a Jewish rebellion against Rome in the 130s, led to an independent Jewish state between about 132 and 135, 136, and until the Emperor Hadrian basically sent in the big dogs, and it was a complete disaster for the Jewish state. Nearly 600,000 Jews killed. Over 900 villages destroyed. Jerusalem was basically leveled. And a new city called, a new pagan capital was built on the site of Jerusalem. And it basically eliminated the Jewish presence in the Holy Land for all intents and purposes, and any hope of an independent Jewish state in the Holy Land for almost 2,000 years. But somebody like Simon Bar Kokhba is who the rabbis are looking for, a temporal leader, someone who will lead the Jewish state to victory and its proper place on the world stage in this time-space continuum. Now, when Jesus returns, when the Messiah returns, he is going to be coming back as a conqueror, but he's coming back in the clouds at the head of a heavenly army. The Jewish rabbis are looking for a man who is well-schooled in the Torah, who is going to be a dynamic political and military leader. And sadly, based on what I read of the prophecies of the Antichrist, I think the Antichrist is going to find himself being hailed as the Messiah by many Jews. Sadly, I think he's also going to be hailed as the Messiah by many Christians who don't know prophecy. And there I've given you the thesis of the project I'm working on. So anyway, Well, there's a lot more in the news, but this program has already got to about an hour and 15 minutes, so we will let that lie. Coming up on A View from the Bunker, Gil Broussard. He's been kind of waiting patiently for me to heal for a couple of weeks so that I can actually carry out a conversation of about an hour. But I am remiss in not having Gil on the program to talk about Planet 7X or Planet X or Nibiru, if you prefer. There have been a number of prophecies out there, including some coming from ultra-Orthodox rabbis like Rabbi Mattatyahu Glazerson, who was a recent interview guest on Skywatch TV, one of the daily updates, talking about the Torah codes, which were pointing to Nibiru and Messiah in the same table, which is kind of interesting. Now, Purim, which has passed about a week and a half ago, was also mentioned as part of that table. But the rabbis believe if Messiah doesn't show up when he's expected, it's only because the Jewish people aren't ready for Messiah yet. And there's another point of difference between Jewish expectation and the Christian understanding of the human condition. I mean, as Christians, we understand that all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. We will never be ready or righteous enough for Messiah. Thank God he came anyway. But Gil Broussard has done a lot of research on Planet 7X and its influence on Earth's history. So as soon as I can carry out a conversation, voice that'll last for a full hour, hopefully sometime this week, that's what we're looking for. Avi Lipkin is also scheduled to make an appearance down here in the Ozarks later this week. If he's got time in his schedule, I'll grab him for A View from the Bunker as well, and Chris Putnam as well. But those, again, still to be confirmed. Our weekly Bible study, the Gilbert House Fellowship, that's something Sharon and I have really taken and made a priority in our weekly schedule because we're really getting a lot out of it. It just goes to show that you don't need to be a credentialed scholar in order to dig deeper into the Bible and get more out of it. If you'd like to join us and follow along as we go through the Bible in chronological order, we do an Old Testament study and a New Testament study, post them every Sunday morning to our Bible study website, the Gilbert House Fellowship. That's gilberthouse.org, gilberthouse.org. This week on Skywatch TV, Sheila Zielinski is the guest. She made the trek down here to the Ozarks and talked about her book, Green Gospel, The New World Religion. That's the program that is airing this week multiple times on our various networks, the Victory Television Network, the Christian Television Network, the Cornerstone Network, and a couple of independent television stations, WGGN in Sandusky, WLLA in Kalamazoo. You'll find all of those listings, dates and times for the program posted at skywatchtv.com. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.